Welcome, guys. Max of the Accidental Engineer here. For those of you guys who don't know who this is Alex Perez, software engineer with EverQuote, a Boston-based startup that is in the car insurance, lead generation, online marketing space. So just for the audience that doesn't know, do you mind sharing a little bit about what it is that you do for EverQuote, Alex?
Yeah, I work as an engineer on the email team. The email team is one of the many traffic teams that we have at EverQuote that drives and redrives traffic back to our website. As an email engineer, I work on just making sure that emails get sent, getting feedback for those emails as far as the events that they generate downstream, and also helping analysts on our email team wire up all of the pipelines that they need to both get their job done and make their job easier. So that involves writing a lot of ETL, working with some small web applications, but yeah, just lots and lots of data. We send roughly 5 million emails a day, so do the math as far as that plus the number of events that we also have to track with those emails.
That's over a billion emails a year.
Good.
So for folks who in the audience are curious about how you end up in a full-time engineering role with a startup, how did you end up finding EverQuote, and did you do your undergrad in CS? Like, how did you end up in the role you're at today?
Yeah, I think I stumbled upon my role. I think I got sort of lucky, and I attribute a lot of things to sort of the people I knew at the time. In college, I studied electrical engineering. So in that sort of space, you do have to learn a little bit of CS, but not a lot. So I knew how to code. I knew what coding was about, but I was not a CS major.
What kind of, programming languages did they cover in your undergrad?
We learned some old school stuff like Fortran.
Nice.
Yeah. Did a lot of stuff with Mathematica, and also some of the things with that, some of the plugins for Mathematica, as well as things like Spice, which are more specifically for electrical engineering type projects. But I did learn some C, some C++, a little bit of Java, but it was maybe one or two classes. It wasn't anything to really get me interested in CS. It was a requisite, a prereq. So I took the classes that I had to take, but I was more interested in the actual sort of the physical side of electrical engineering. So circuit design, and even in that sort of domain, more of the analog stuff, less of the solid state stuff, less of the logic.
I know from just having known you for this long that you've done your own work on guitar amplifiers,
yeah,
and guitar pedals, and like,
yeah,
audio modulation,
yeah,
which is pretty different than your full-time gig, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it's all physics. I love the fact that with playing guitar, there's a lot of physics involved.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you play the electric guitar as an electrical engineer, there's so much that you can do that the average musician really can't do. So I sort of serve as both a musician and as a tech, where I understand how things work, so I can both modify, repair, all of that stuff, maintenance.
For sure.
Yeah. So I've always had that type of mindset where, just sort of the engineer in me just liked sort of knowing how things worked. Breaking things is a huge aspect of that. Being okay with breaking things, for sure.
Well, you did your undergrad in electrical engineering. You didn't go directly into software engineering.
Nope.
I mean, do you mind if I share a little bit of the background I know about you, which is that out of college, out of Yale, you went and worked at Guitar Center for several years as a professional salesperson, doing very well, besides touring with your bands. So it's kind of accidental that you ended up at EverQuote, which I believe was your first software engineering job.
Yeah. I was doing music full time. So yeah, working at Guitar Center. I was playing in a handful of bands, and one of my college friends, so this was already 4 or 5 years out of college, but one of my college friends was in town, and he worked at what is now EverQuote. You worked with him.
For sure.
And I think jokingly, I asked him how work was. I knew nothing about what he did. I knew nothing about what EverQuote did. Nor did I really even care, I would argue. But I asked him, you know, sort of just one of those small talky questions, how's work? And he said, good, we're hiring. And at the time, I wanted to sort of switch back into engineering. I wanted to go back to school. I was thinking about getting a master's. So I was already starting to pull away from the music scene and just go back into that. And so when he said that they were hiring, I followed up on the joke and I said, oh, you should hire me. And
so you had this in.
I had it
via a classmate.
Yeah.
Were you at all intimidated when you were going through the interview process? Or
absolutely. I mean, well, yes and no. So the first part of the interview happened in a Best Buy.
For real?
Yeah.
Like which aisle?
Guitar pedal aisle? I don't remember. Or? I think Daryl is like looking for an Apple TV remote because he had lost his. But that's where this conversation was happening. And so after I said, oh, you should hire me, he started asking me one of the interview questions that we would phone screen a lot with. In the aisle of a Best Buy. And it didn't really hit me until a few minutes later after I was sort of deeper into the question. But it hit me. This guy's interviewing me right now. and he asked, you know, I got through the question and he said something along the lines of like, oh, that was really good, better than most people, something, something, something. But that was it. So we left Best Buy, and I left that weekend flattered. I was, you know, sort of like, oh, that was kind of cool. You know, it's hearing that from him was really reinforcing. So it sort of just told me that both leaving music and getting back into that side of thinking was probably a good thing to do. I was ready. I was capable. And then later that week, he sent me a message on Facebook just saying like, hey, when did you want to come up and interview? And again, that just sideswiped me. It caught me off guard. And I was kind of scared.
So when Daryl, your then manager.
Yeah, then manager.
When he invited you to interview, was that for an engineering role, or have you gradually, on the job, been promoted or transitioned from one team to engineering? How did you orchestrate that? Because I think a lot of people are in analyst type roles or just non-engineering roles.
Yeah,
and they're learning the technical chops and are debating maybe going to like a boot camp or whether they can learn enough on the job and get their employer to agree to.
Yeah, so fast forward a little bit. I was hired as an analyst. That's where I met Max.
For sure.
I'm not sure if this is true at, at other companies where analysts also need to sort of have some type of a technical background, but I think there we definitely did, and I quickly realized that I just wasn't any good at it. At being an analyst. I mean, I was a critical thinker, whatever, but I was just more drawn to writing code, which, you know, was a part of the job. And I think I, from that moment, I started grooming myself to try to fill more of that role, because back then, you know, EverQuote was still like under 50 people, and everybody had a lot of roles. You know, there weren't really defined like analyst teams or engineering teams. Maybe there were, but at least on the team that I worked on, that we worked on, I would have said otherwise back then. So I think I, as we grew, as we started hiring more people for our team, I sort of just became the de facto, and this was sort of like after you had already kind of left or moved to another team, but I sort of became like the de facto grandfathered in sort of like technical analyst, the lead technical analyst on that team. And we didn't have a dedicated engineering team for email at the time, so I was doing all of those engineering type projects for our team.
What was the learning curve for the skills that you are kind of, you're kind of dancing around how your responsibilities changed from being an analyst to an engineer? What were the skills that were demanded of you as you made that switch over?
It's really hard to say.
You're good.
Okay. It's really hard to say sort of where the learning curve came in or how it came in, because in a lot of ways maybe I'm still on it, but I think, and I don't really tell anybody this, but I think that one of the things that I thought I was good at was and hopefully this doesn't sound bad, but faking it. Where
sure.
I love to look at code. I love to read other people's code, other people's work. And I think I was just really good at picking things up. And I don't really think I mean, we all have bad habits, but I think I avoided a lot of the bad habits that I see other sort of maybe junior engineers or people that are trying to, you know, step into more of a technical role. I think just from looking at a lot of other code all of the time, I sort of picked up a lot of the do's and don'ts, and I skipped a lot of steps. I didn't do it. So, you know, bringing up boot camps, I didn't feel like I had to, you know, enter a boot camp.
For sure.
So I'm a big proponent of, you know, just learning things myself. There are resources. I mean, the resources are out there.
You described dodging some of the mistakes that maybe newbies make in learning how to program or engineer. Can you like give a few examples like that you dodged and why you might have been able to dodge them? Where
yeah,
somebody with your,
I mean, a lot of it. The most specific I can maybe get deals with both the stylistic aspects of coding. So just, I mean, people can write ugly code. I
for
hate
sure.
that. Like, I think maybe the artist in me, if there is one, the artist in me really loves beautiful code. So I really, I like making my code look good. But then also just sort of proofing your code. You don't want to write bad code stuff. You want to test for tolerances, stress testing, edge cases, things that I think about a lot, because I mean, one of the sort of the most stressful, embarrassing things you can go through as an engineer is, you know, is releasing something and then having it just fall face forward right away.
So to give like an idea of the scale of that problem in EverQuote and the role you're in, if you're sending 5 million emails a day, you can imagine how releasing bad code that might double or triple it from 5 million emails to 15 million emails a day could cause disaster.
Yes.
Or let's say it goes from 5 million emails to zero, you might make $0 that day, which might be better than the inverse, but... the point being is that it sounds like was ever quote in your transition from analyst to engineer a more forgiving environment than you're imagining some other people might go through as they learn programming? Like, what made EverQuote in your role a more forgiving or easier to learn in environment for getting past mistakes that other people make as they're learning how to program? And
that's a good question. I'm still not sure. I mean, sure. I think there's just sort of knowing that you're not alone, I guess. I mean, we have hands to put out fires. And also it sort of takes time to know where to look. Like if things do hit the fan, then being able to know exactly where to look when things are going bad.
Where are some places to look? I mean, I guess there's probably proprietary things that EverQuote has for monitoring if your team members has released bad code and are doing bad things. But are there any that you can share with us that might help beginners on their own projects avoid disaster? Are there techniques that you learned early on that, I mean, maybe not, maybe writing tests or maybe using version control or...
Yeah, I mean, all of those things for sure. I mean, on the subject of tests, I was aware early on that as a good engineer should write good tests. However, I think the culture, at least on our team, up until recently didn't have that element of writing tests for everything that we release. So still have things that break upon release.
This is like an economic thing where when you're a startup and you're making zero money, there's really enforcing test writing as a requirement is just imposing cost on a process that currently makes no money. So there's some like evolutionary point in time where suddenly you're making money or you have customers that depend on you, and every iterative change you might make to your software can actually make you lose money. And that once there is value at risk, then there's like this inflection point where some of your team should be writing tests, and like you got to be much more careful about team members releasing buggy code.
Yeah.
Like, when, so you're saying that happened relatively recently. What were like some events that triggered that realization, if not you, in you, it may be in your teammates?
I think specifically on my team, some of us do write tests and some don't. So it's a very, 9 times out of 10, the things that do end up breaking, those of us that do write tests usually do a bit of finger pointing by saying, hey, that could have been, you could have written a test for that. It could have been avoided.
Do you guys have any kind of like, slapping of the hand or like, public humiliation for F-ups?
Maybe in the office, I work alone. Okay. But no. Not really. I mean, it's all in the name of just making sure that things work. If somebody messes up, I mean, yeah, you'll feel bad about it, but by no means do we sort of castigate that person publicly. Yeah.
So we haven't covered this topic at all, but besides Alex starting as an analyst at a startup and moving into an engineering role, Alex is relatively uncommon in his role as being a fully remote salaried employee, which is why you just mentioned being on your own. You can't physically walk over to your teammate who's released bad code and confront them about it. You can only ping them on Slack or HipChat or whatever.
Yeah, you can gossip on Slack.
So, I mean, do you guys have a code review process? Like, how has that evolved
in
your career?
So that type of process has been more of a company-wide thing.
Okay.
Where it's not just specific to my team, but across all engineering teams, as we've grown and as we've created more well-defined engineering teams specific to the traffic teams or dedicated to the traffic teams. I think one team developed a very, very, very cool sort of review process that everybody just really agreed on. And so we've adopted that review process where you need to prepare pull requests with links to documentation that you've already written. You need to supply at least two reviewers. You need to have written a test. It needs to have passed tests. Demonstrations of local testing locally and on staging, lots of things.
For sure.
Yeah, so it makes reviewing a lot easier, both on the reviewer and the reviewee, because you're able to sort of just track where in the review process things are, and there's very little handholding on the side of the reviewer when it comes time for them to review, because I've written a good pull request, you know, or
for sure.
I presented or opened a good pull request. So yeah, that the review process hasn't really changed that much, because everybody really likes sort of the way it works, and that's across all engineering.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't know. What else would you want to cover? One of the things I'm curious about is, sorry.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, I haven't talked about sort of like how I became a remote worker and
what
it's like being a remote
yeah,
worker.
Yeah. So I know this is like kind of a desirable position to be in. At least many people who aren't in that position might think so, because maybe you're just starting a family, or you want
getting
to move
married.
To a lower cost of living. You were getting married, and you have a partner who has their own geographic restrictions that are independent of maybe your current employer. So, yeah, kind of share your story about how you ended up.
Yeah.
Remote.
Well, it was 6 months in as an analyst, where I was at a crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of living in New Haven and Boston at the same time, sort of as a safety net in the event that I didn't like working or living in Boston. But that wasn't the case. But then the next sort of fork in the road was, I really do like working here, but does that mean I'm moving to Boston? Because, you know, again, at the time I wanted to go back to school, and that involved moving back to California. At that point, I had been living on the East Coast for about 8 or 9 years. So that was a third of my life. That was 8, 9 years too many, I think.
So you did some rapport and trust building with whomever it is
yes. That's
your manager.
So
how do you get them to say yes, or when did you ask, and was it like were you nervous about asking?
So nervous, but at the same time, it was just I really wanted to move home. You know, I wanted to be closer to my family, and I think up until that point, I think I was doing a good job. I built rapport. The company was small enough so that. You know, sort of the word that I wanted to leave the company got to our CEO very quickly. And also, you know, my friend that sort of introduced me to EverQuote was also a VP at the time. So, and he really cared about me. He was looking out for me. And I guess I had some sort of value. And and I mentioned that, you know, I would be leaving on good terms, and so I think all of those things bundled together sort of left them thinking, well, hey, what if you kept your job? This was sort of the exact conversation, but hey, what if you kept your job? You know, we'd really like to keep you on. We think you're doing good work. Go back to California, be close to your family, but stay with us, please.
So I think this sounds a lot like a lot of various negotiation scenarios where one of the things that I'm hearing is that you're ready to walk away from the negotiation. If, I mean, you didn't, it doesn't sound like you initiated the conversation about being a full-time remote salaried
Because then
person,
that
but
was another thing to consider. Well, do I just want to, have a clean cut? Do I just want to move back to California and figure it out over there? Or do I want to, continue my experience with EverQuote just on the other side of the country? And I mean, yeah, I was having a good time. I liked my coworkers, and I mean, it also, for me, it sort of like removed the worry of, oh, I gotta find another job. For some people that's exciting, but maybe for me, just because I had just done, to me at the time, it felt like a complete life change. Being a starving artist and then being salaried at a cool, hip, up-and-coming tech company, I felt like I would have been, leaving something good behind. So I think I was enthusiastic to see what it could. I mean, still to this day, I don't think I'll ever have this opportunity again to be a 100% remote worker.
Really?
So, well, I mean, maybe, but I just think that the fact that this has gone on for, I've been remote for, about 3 years now. That's longer than I've, I've been with the company 3.5 years. So I was only ever in Boston for about 6 months. But anyways, yeah, I just thought it'd be cool to see what it would be like to be a remote worker. Yeah, I think ultimately I was just really happy to go home. And I think that happiness compounded with the fact that I didn't have to worry about finding a job when I got out there, just yeah, put me in a really good spot. And so yeah, I think I was really at that point really motivated to do a good job. I felt like, they were sort of doing me a favor, and I wanted to give that back. And at first I was going back and forth between Boston and California pretty frequently, at least once a month. But after a year, I felt like I'd sort of put in my dues, and that backed off. I did kind of, I felt worn out a little bit, but I sort of reduced that cadence to maybe once every 3 months. And I mean, it's July now. The last time I was there was in January. So,
Got it.
and I still don't really have plans to go back. But it's cool. I mean, I do my job, and I think I do it well, and other people see that too. So that's all that really matters, I think.
So working remote aside, let me put an idea out there and let me know what your opinion of that idea is, which is for people who have not had an engineering role yet and maybe considering boot camps or considering applying to engineering roles for which they may or may not be qualified, it's better to try and get a role, even if it's not as an engineer, like an analyst, which where you started out with at EverQuote. Because it gives you a foothold into the visibility inside of a business to what is valuable to learn. Like, one of the things that I've heard people ask is, what programming language should I learn first? And in my opinion, the answer to that is go look at the jobs listings that look interesting to you and see what it says in the job requirements and just learn that. So when you consider what your life might have been like if you had done a boot camp instead of taking the analyst role, do you think you would have been better off 6 months out, 2 years out, it than if you had done what you ended up doing, which was go the analyst route and then work with your employer to move teams?
It's tough to say. The only The only data point I have for someone who, or so I have a few data points, but my brother did the boot camp approach, and I think the boot camp thing is interesting. It's definitely sort of fast paced. It's a lot to learn in 10 to 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They're also really expensive. One of the cool thing, well, I'm not sure if all of them do this, but one of the cool things that the boot camp that my brother did had was that they sort of only asked for a certain amount up front. They would help you get a job. In fact, it was a requirement. You couldn't pass the boot camp unless you got a job, and they helped you, and then you paid the rest back.
Got it.
So I thought that was really cool.
Besides financing, and like figuring out how to pay for it or paying it off after you've gotten the job post graduation of boot camp, like information intake wise, I'd argue that you get more valuable information about what you should be learning on the job than you could possibly get in 12
weeks. I agree. I've said this before, and I think I'll say it again, but I think when you meet people that did the boot camp thing, you can tell them apart from maybe people that took a more organic approach. And you could argue, like, well, what's the difference between a boot camp and majoring in CS? But I think doing the boot camp thing means that at some point something went off in your head that said that you needed to get out of where you were, or you needed to have a life change. I don't think people are intrinsically interested in CS.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe the academic subject.
Yes.
For sure.
And specific to the people that go into a boot camp. I think it's just, I think it's more about the end, the end product. And that's both in, you know, working on sort of like the tech side of things. I mean, we've glorified tech at this point. We have a TV show about it now.
Silicon Valley,
what up? And also the money. I mean, so I think I'd argue that, you can tell those people apart where they're just not really as, they're not... What was I going to say?
You were saying that there's something that distinguishes between boot camp grads and people who've gone an organic route with a job.
Yeah, yeah. I think those people are just sort of trying it out. They're much like I feel like I've sort of found the thing that I really enjoy doing the most. I learn every day. I think it's awesome. It exercises all of my interests. I get to look at things. I don't get to work with my hands. I like working with my hands, but it's still very tangible. And I don't think that the boot campers, the booties, whatever, the boot campers have that. They don't have those interests. I mean,
so I've been ragging on boot camps. And now,
well, it's just
and now
really,
you've been ragging on boot camps.
It's really interesting when you meet, you know, an English major, a lit major that did
sure,
a boot
sure.
camp. It's they're just not in the same mindset as a. They don't have an engineering mindset.
Let's say you and I were designing a boot camp from scratch to maximize for our graduates.
To maximize
our graduates' compensation out of the boot camp. What skills and topics do you think should be covered in, like, that compensation maximizing boot camp?
Oh man.
We'll finish on this question. I'm just curious your hot take on that topic, because as you say, people who are doing this career transition, some of them are doing it for compensation, some of them are doing it because they want more interesting work that has a longer career horizon. So what do you think an optimal curriculum would be for your idealized boot camp?
That's tough. I mean, I've never thought about this, but I do tell myself that I wish boot camps taught a little more intuition.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of emphasis on the term full stack. You know, there's a lot to learn in that stack. So, you know, you sort of all, you know, all 10 to 12 weeks are really taken up by learning whatever stack they're trying to get you up to speed on. So yeah, you can build your own app in 10 to 12 weeks, but I don't think that there wasn't really a lot of intuition there. And so I think that's probably one of the biggest issues with boot camps is that you learn how to do something, but you kind of only know how to do it one way. And I wouldn't really, I'd argue that you don't really sort of know 100% what's going on. So I would love to learn, or I would have loved to learn,
sure,
if I took a boot camp at this point, how does the internet work? You know, how do,
for sure,
how do computers talk to each other?
this is truly full stack. Like when we were talking about full stack earlier, we were talking about how in boot camps, basically there's the browser where most web applications are accessed down to a database somewhere on planet Earth that stores some type of data that's created, read, and updated and deleted. So when you say how the internet works, you mean like, how is data passed from the browser on your phone or on your laptop?
Transfer protocols, like, yeah. So, like,
text,
RFC.
Serialization.
Yeah, like, lots of things.
Are there any particular kind of well-abstracted set of tools that you think would be good to cover? Like, when it helps not just to know, okay, HTTP, Hypertext Transfer Protocol, is the protocol for data to be passed between on port 80 or 443, and like maybe showing people how to use a developer's console in a browser where people can peek under the covers of their browser, mm-hmm, and see a log of all, mm-hmm, the HTTP messages that are being passed.
Yeah.
Like, is that an example of a skill or a topic?
I think so.
I mean, I want to hear yours. So.
Well, I mean, it's like I said, it's tough because I, you know, I've never really thought about this, but I think it's just from my experiences with the data points that I have, my brother and some of his friends. Also, it's sort of a chain reaction where, you know, people only do boot camps because of, you know, their firsthand experiences with other people that have done boot camps.
Yeah.
I think.
People, when they first started, like maybe 2005, people, there had to be a first generation that weren't referred, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah. But with those data points, my brother is a front end guy at LinkedIn right now. Pretty lucrative, I'd say.
For sure.
And he's only been doing sort of front-end stuff for about 2 years. But I think, well, also, it might be a time thing, right? Where, I mean, boot camps, as you've said, have been around for a while, but as you sort of meet people, you don't meet people that did boot camps 10 years ago. At least I don't. I mean,
yeah.
Well, I meet people that did boot camps a year ago.
This might be a selection bias.
Right. I think that's what it is. It's a selection bias. So you can't really blame those people. Like, they probably, you know, have only really been comfortable with, you know, a command line for a little over a year, or
mm-hmm,
as, you know, as long as they've been out of the boot camp. So just, I mean, that speaks to me just saying that, yeah, you can't really expect them to know too much. But yeah, I think, like, boot camps, in order to be profitable, they have to be able to sort of replicate what they offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, their sort of syllabus, I guess, has to be very well structured. And I think it will naturally miss a lot of things that you will probably end up learning down the line. But again, for me, I didn't do a boot camp, but I still would have liked to have learned a lot of things that I am currently learning. I would have loved to have learned it a long time ago, before some of the things that maybe I learned or taught myself back then.
So you're now a number of years into your engineering, software engineering career. What are the skills that you don't know yet that you're most excited about becoming an expert in the next few years of your career?
Personally, I'd like to sort of become more of, as we've said, a full stack engineer, where I don't just deal with the back end stuff, but I can also mess around with the front end stuff. I'm not so interested in like learning HTML or CSS, but you know, if I needed to get that done for, you know, a personal project, then it'd be cool to, you know, sort of be much more handy with that.
So HTML and CSS.
Yeah, but I'm happy with what I do because it's a lot more abstract. You know, I don't really have to deal with styling. You know, I like dealing with structures, and thinking about quantities and qualities and rates, and yeah, I like thinking more quantitatively.
So we've kind of danced around this topic, but I think for some of our audience, or for many people, their understanding of software engineering and programming is HTML and CSS. Like, they see programming as making a web page. So for the folks who aren't familiar with what you do as an engineer at EverQuote, what programming languages, softwares do you work with on a regular basis that aren't HTML and CSS that make what you do a full-time job?
So yeah, I mean, I guess my stack is, so I deal with Python. I think Python, at least for dealing with data, is Python, I'd argue, is sort of the handiest thing, the sort of the go-to language for dealing with that kind of stuff. And our company uses a lot of MySQL databases.
Sure.
Do a little bit of Postgres. Some people do Mongo. We just started getting into Spark clusters, so that's something that I'm currently sort of excited to get into. But yeah, I would say my bread and butter is definitely Python and MySQL. And I think I can do with 100% of the work that I do, I can get away with doing everything that I need to do 80% of the time with Python and MySQL.
For sure. Maybe using Python to drive your SQL.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, I think there's a lot of room for growth with Spark. I think SQL is going to be around for a long while yet.
There are lots of different flavors and... definitely learn how to query a database for sure. Booties, the boot campers, they'll learn how to query. They'll understand what a database is and some concepts about what relational databases are and cardinality and things like that. Querying is important. And then using something to wrap that so that you can do things in automated or triggered fashions.
For sure. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us, Alex. Yeah. Thanks for sharing your experience so far. We should do this again sometime soon.
Yeah, on the road.